You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, online scams and bots are targeting U.S. military veterans and active duty service members as part of disinformation campaigns. We'll talk to a veteran who's devoted his career to tracking down those schemes. Right now, it's time for our Wisconsin News Roundup. We'll talk with reporters around the state about the stories they're following. First, the state's Joint Finance Committee decided not to allocate funding for a new youth prison to be built in the town of Hortonia, just northwest of Appleton. Many residents and officials there had opposed the site for the new prison since it was proposed by Governor Evers last year. Mika Solner is a local government and politics reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. Mika, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, Governor Evers had proposed Hortonia as one of six smaller sites to replace the Lincoln Hills Youth Prison last year. When that announcement came out, what concerns did people in the area have?
Yeah, so a lot of the concerns revolved around not having enough resources to sustain a facility of that size, at least by local officials. They felt that they wouldn't be able to supply it with sewer and water services. They also didn't have a presence of a local police department. Residents also felt that it could possibly turn away business from the area as well as bring down property values. And there was also a larger concern in the way the state handled how to announce that, which was they didn't notify any local officials before they, you know, made it public that that was the preferred site for the new youth prison.
What do we know about why the state had preferred Hortonia as a site?
Yeah, so the biggest reason would be that the parcel of land that they were looking for was state-owned, but additionally, the location was pretty central to the home communities of the inmates who would have been housed in that prison. And they also took into consideration resources that were close by, like schools, businesses, medical services, and neighborhoods that were nearby as well.
What kind of action did people and officials in the area take to oppose this concept?
Yeah, so for about the last year, residents really kind of spearheaded this grassroots effort to make their opposition known. They sent a petition signed by over 700 citizens of that area to the state. They wrote to their local lawmakers and they, you know, held press conferences, and everywhere around Hortonia, you could see these signs that said no prison in Hortonia to show this visible reaction to the state's decision.
And what's been the reaction so far to this announcement from Joint Finance that they weren't funding this site?
So the reaction of both by residents and local officials has been largely celebratory. Residents see, you know, what they have done kind of on the ground to kind of create awareness of this as, you know, their work has been paid off is how they kind of view the decision. Local officials say that they're pretty relieved by this. And they very much see it as a victory.
Mika, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks.
Mika Solner is a local government and politics reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. She talked to us about reaction in Hortonia after lawmakers decided against building a new, smaller youth prison in the town. Next, this week marked the 35th anniversary of Superior Days at the state capitol, when officials from counties in northern Wisconsin meet with state lawmakers to talk about key issues in their area. This year, access to mental health care was one of the big topics of discussion. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. She traveled to the Capitol this week to cover Superior Days. Danny, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
One big issue in Superior Days had to do with the lack of facilities for mental health care. What kind of things are people looking at?
Yeah, it's really a lack of inpatient services, also outpatient, but inpatient is a very big concern because, you know, Douglas County, where Superior is a border county with Minnesota, as many people know. And, you know, the closest hospitals would be just across the border. But the hospitals across the border will not often accept medical assistance or Medicaid when those people are brought in. And so that creates a conflict for mental health officials trying to get people in crisis the care that they need. And that often means that they have to send them hours away, either to Eau Claire or sometimes 5 hours away to Oshkosh to be housed at the Winnebago Mental Health Institute.
And it sounds like this can get really expensive for local budgets in northern Wisconsin.
Yes, definitely. The deputy director for Douglas County Health and Human Services, Dave Longstorff, has said that this can cost upwards of $30,000 or more per month to house one individual at the Winnebago Mental Health Institute. And so if you have multiple commitments or multiple people in crisis that need to be cared for there, it becomes very costly over time. And the county saw more than 50 commitments last year, and he said two-thirds of those were at Winnebago.
What is driving the lack of these inpatient facilities as local officials see it?
Really, it is the Medicaid reimbursement rates. They are lower than nearby Minnesota's. Dave Longsdorf, that deputy director with Douglas County Health and Human Services, says it's about half of what Minnesota's Medicaid reimbursement rates are. So if providers have an option, they're going to go practice in Minnesota. Because it's just not feasible economically for them to provide that care. Same thing with hospitals here in Douglas County. Longsdorf said that there was recently a hospital in Superior that he spoke with, and they decided against providing this kind of care because it would be very costly to them, maybe a loss of $1 million a year for them to provide that to people.
So you have local officials from the Lake Superior shoreline up there in Madison. What kind of policies are they advocating for to help fix some of these problems?
Well, they'd really like to see an increase in those Medicaid reimbursement rates in order to get people the care that they need closer to home. And that's a really big difficulty for the state. You know, they've been trying to provide increases in rates where they can, as funding allows. They have increased the rates for nursing homes in recent years. But it's just not enough to meet the need. And so they were down there pushing for that increase once again, as they have in the past. And they also said that they would support legislation that's being considered that would add additional psychiatric beds in Eau Claire County, because that ends up being sometimes the closest facility that they can send people to for care.
Danny, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rob.
Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. She talked with us about officials from northern Wisconsin advocating for more mental health resources during Superior Days at the state capitol. Next, UW River Falls is being threatened with a lawsuit by a conservative Christian law firm from Arizona. The suit claims that one of the school's policies violates students' free speech rights. Rich Kramer is WPR's reporter based in Eau Claire. Rich, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
What is at the root of this threat of a lawsuit from this Arizona firm?
Well, the lawsuit, the firm is claiming that UW River Falls has a policy on that affects free speech that it says is unconstitutional. It all goes back to last year, last September, actually. A student on campus was trying to organize a chapter of a conservative student group called Turning Point USA. And she was on campus. She had a large beach ball that she was inflating and having students write, you know, free speech messages on the ball. And the goal was to roll it through campus and kind of drum up support and recruit students to this chapter that she wanted to form. She was approached, and she and her friends were approached by a campus administrator who said that because she wasn't a part of a registered and organized and recognized student group on campus, that she wasn't able to do those activities. The administrator said that only student orgs can, and they have to reserve space, and they have to get permission, basically, to do that. And the student, in the video, there was a video that was posted by one of the student's friends, I believe, and was circulated by another group that's all about free speech issues on campus. And the students all appeared to just accept administrator said, and that was the end of it. But then the student had followed up with through emails to the administration and felt she didn't get the answer, a straight answer. So she reached out to this law firm, I guess. And then as of this week, she, through the law firm, mentioned that she had obtained legal counsel.
And what's the law firm seeking now from UW River Falls?
In short, they want the university to change the policy. First, they want them to identify clearly what policy they were citing and saying that you have to get prior written approval and have to be part of a student group to be able to organize and recruit students on campus, and then to get rid of that policy. And the letter that the law firm sent basically implies that if they don't do that by the February 24th, then there could be litigation to come.
And have we heard anything from UW-River Falls in response?
Yeah, River Falls, UW-River Falls spokesperson sent me some policies that they said that regulated and kind of that they used to sort out that situation in September. And they also pointed out that the policy on that campus is in line with the policy at UW System. Other than that, they wouldn't comment. They said any formal response to the letter is going to come through consultation with the campus administration and legal counsel at UW System.
Rich, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter in Eau Claire. He talked with us about a conservative Arizona law firm threatening UW River Falls with a free speech lawsuit. He finishes out our state news roundup. The American intelligence community and Robert Mueller's investigative team have documented extensive Russian interference in the 2016 election. But there's another area of cyber attacks going on that our next guest has been working to uncover and expose against active duty military and veterans in particular. Chris Goldsmith testified before Congress in November last year about a report he compiled for Vietnam Veterans of America. It lays out a chilling coordinated effort to target military members and their families through social media and aimed at upsetting American democracy in the process. Chris is Chief Investigator and Associate Director for Policy and Government Affairs with Vietnam Veterans of America. He is an Iraq War Army veteran. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Tell us about, Chris, when you first noticed something on social media that that led you into tracking down this story.
So about 2.5 years ago, I was helping Vietnam Veterans America's communications director manage the social media account. I am a millennial, so kind of working for a Vietnam vets group. It's one of the additional tasks that were handed to me. And I noticed that there was what looked like kind of like a duplicate of our Facebook page using the same congressionally chartered veteran service organization logo and name, but it wasn't us. And most disturbingly, the audience was something like twice the size of ours.
What kind of messages were being shared on this fake Vietnam Veterans of America social media page?
So at first, I went over to the page and looked at it, and I noticed that they were sharing a website, vvets.eu. And I'm thinking, I click on it, I look at it, and it's sharing real news related to the veterans community and specifically Vietnam vets. And I think at first, okay, we've got chapters literally all around the world. And I'm thinking maybe this is just a European chapter that's unchartered and they are out there, you know, kind of doing a great job of building a social media audience and thinking at first, maybe we should find this chapter leader and offer them a job. And when I started poking around a little more, I noticed that they were sharing real news that had things like the date change. There was a Stars and Stripes article about the first Trump budget, which would have cut benefits for elderly veterans who are old enough to collect Social Security and are also totally and permanently unemployable. Real news story, but shared 3 months after the fact. Now, when this really happened, we activated our members. Those who would have been affected by this budget proposal had the appropriate reaction, which was kind of to freak out, because in real terms, if this budget proposal went through, you know, they could be homeless a couple months later. So I recognized the article and basically did a simple plagiarism search and found the real one. And I came to realize that this, you know, wasn't some foreign chapter leader. This was a foreign entity who was out there to basically sow chaos in the veterans community.
And this, it turned out, was the tip of the iceberg. What was the extent of things when you started digging into this?
So this particular entity, after basically fighting with Facebook without any luck at all for months to get it taken down, We appealed to Congress. We appealed to the press. Stars and Stripes was the publisher of the article that had been plagiarized. So they had, you know, a stake. They are partially DOD funded. So the Pentagon has a stake in making sure that their own media is not being used as propaganda against veterans. We came to find out that this original entity was from Bulgaria. When we got their Facebook page and their website shut down, they recreated it. Thankfully, forgot to do it anonymously, so we got a name and address in Plovdiv, Bulgaria. And that episode was just the first. A couple months later, when we found the new version, we kind of fell down this rabbit hole. And since then, I've found well over 100 veteran-focused Facebook pages that are of foreign origin, which are, you know, their primary motivating factor seems to be to said so disarray and confusion in the American veterans community.
Who is behind, as far as you know, who is behind the bulk of these websites, of these social media sites?
It's tends to be, you know, from Eastern European companies, that's countries. And that's, you know, if we take Facebook's publicly available information at face value, you know, I would assume that if there's a sophisticated actor like the Russians behind this, that they would use things like a virtual private network or VPN to basically make it look like they're operating from somewhere else. We have found other pages that did apparently have administrators in Russia. And then these aren't just random Facebook pages, you know, with a few hundred followers. I'm talking about like 250,000 followers, you know, that have larger online followings than, you know, some presidential campaigns that in their, you know, first few months of launching. And the practical effect of this type of thing is not just to target the veterans community, but veterans are in the United States quite a well-respected population. You know, for your listeners, imagine, you know, if they are a veteran themselves or their family member is, you tend to, you know, listen to a veteran when they have opinions on things like foreign policy. And if these foreign entities, Russia and elsewhere, are convincing American veterans that say Russia is not attacking our elections, that may not just sway the opinion and the vote of one veteran, but the friends and family that come with each veteran.
You also have concerns about active duty military potentially in potentially hostile places around the world being targeted by these kind of social media efforts. What kind of things do you see or worry about?
So earlier this week, Facebook did another massive purge of foreign disinformation pages. And one was very similar to the things that I've been found, except instead of targeting American veterans, it was targeting Ukrainian veterans, specifically veterans of the ongoing conflict between Ukraine and Russia. And the things that they have done to Ukrainian soldiers and their families are beyond belief. In one example, they basically found a Ukrainian infantry company. They got their roster. Then they looked at their social media pages, found their families, text messaged their families on their personal phones saying that their soldiers had been killed, an entire company's worth of Ukrainian soldiers. Their families all got these messages. Now, the intent was not just the psychological warfare against these soldiers and their families. The Ukrainian population being primed for this kind of disinformation campaign, the family members responded by texting their soldiers to say, like, hey, you know, want to let you know that we've been targeted by this thing. Now, what Russia did was they basically set up cell phone towers in the conflict zones in Crimea, and they waited for a bunch of incoming phone calls and text messages to appear on their map. And when they saw that, they had the physical location of this company of soldiers, and then they fired artillery on them. Now, that is the intersection of psychological, cyber, and kinetic warfare. It's something that can be used against our our soldiers, Marines, who are currently in Syria and Afghanistan today. And as a lot of your listeners know, there have been more than a few instances where American troops have come face to face with Russian mercenaries who are maybe not wearing a Russian uniform, but they are very close with the Kremlin.
In our last minute or so, Chris, what are you looking for from the White House and from Congress on these issues?
Well, on December 18th, Vietnam Veterans America wrote a letter to the president to let him know that this was going on, to bring to his attention, because, you know, despite the press that we've gotten, we haven't received a response from the White House or anyone in the executive branch. And in that, we included, you know, one of our report's findings, which your listeners can go to vva.org/trollreport to see the entire thing. Last year, we found that Veterans for Trump, which is a political action committee, had their Facebook page stolen. And then it was managed by Macedonians for months. And these Macedonians were stealing political donations from Trump-supporting veterans. We wrote that in our letter to President Trump. We expected that to get his attention, but here we are 2 months later. We haven't received any sort of response. So, you know, we're hoping that if we highlight for the president that his supporters, that veterans are being targeted, that we'll get his attention. But, you know, it hasn't worked yet.
Chris, thanks for bringing this to our attention. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
That's Chris Goldsmith, Chief Investigator and Associate Director for Policy and Government Affairs with Vietnam Veterans of America. We talked to him today about his work uncovering and exposing examples of foreign actors attacking military members and veterans and spreading disinformation through social media. Imagine going through every item you've accumulated in the last 30 or 40 years of your life, more or less, depending on your age. That could take a lot of time. It's easy to get bogged down in just trying to clean one room. But that's what many older adults need to do as they grow older and maybe move to a smaller house and downsize along the way. And if it's not the older adult doing it, the job often falls to a close friend or family member. Last month, we talked to Adam Minter, author of the book Secondhand: Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. He told us how going through his own mother's things sparked the idea for his book.
It's sort of the second period of mourning that, you know, those of us who live in consumer societies encounter. You know, after your parent is gone or your loved one or your friend, you are left with that material legacy. These things that may have mattered to your relative, but don't necessarily matter that much to you. And we reached the end of this process of cleaning out my mother's home and cleaning stuff out of garages of relatives where she had left stuff. And we found ourselves staring at her china, saying to each other, "You take it. No, you take it. No, you take it."
If that sounds familiar to you, we have two guests with us to make things a little easier. Joe Fishman is the owner of Empty the Nest, a Minnesota-based company that offers home cleanouts for people who are transitioning to new spaces, for new stages in their lives. They focus on minimizing waste and maximizing reuse, which they do in part with a vintage-focused thrift store. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
And Marianne,
pleasure to be here.
And Marianne Garidi is in the studio with me. She's president and owner of Moving Forward, a company focused on helping seniors downsize based in Dane County. Marianne's also a certified senior move manager. Marianne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, in our lifetimes, we get a lot of stuff. Can you talk a little bit about what you've observed in your work when people start to make those decisions of what they have to get rid of when they move to a smaller space? Marianne, let's start with you.
Okay, sure. So yeah, it's really tough. And lots of times when I first meet with my clients to do a new client visit, basically they're just super overwhelmed and they don't know where to start. And often they will say that, you know, we have so much to go through, I may not even be able to move for another 6 months yet. And so our goal is just to kind of break it apart and go room by room with them, kind of discuss what they really love the most and what will fit into their new space, and just kind of go through that downsizing process, really almost, you know, again, walking through the whole system with them just to take away that stress and make it much easier on the clients and then their family members.
And Joe, it sounds like it's, you know, it's a logistical process and it's an emotional process at the same time. How do those two get in the way of each other sometimes?
It's a very emotional process. Oftentimes we'll come in after a company like Marianne does the downsizing and we'll take a look at what's left. And oftentimes the family or whomever has a hard time looking at that and letting go of it. And a lot of our people, when we're dealing with the clients, are very good at, you know, working with them and talking with them about one of the things that we're able to do, especially with the prized possessions they've got, is we repurpose it through our thrift store, is it gets a second life. So they know it's not being tossed. And oftentimes that emotional piece will lay to rest a lot of the burden that they have on getting rid of it.
Marianne, I think a lot of people are in that situation and they want to give that stuff to a loved one. They're hoping that that loved one will cherish that good. The loved ones may not necessarily want it. How can we, I guess, let go of that hope when clearly nobody wants to take the stuff?
Sure. And it's definitely something that we come across, like especially things that are really important that's been in the family for a long time. And so as we're working through discussing with our clients that your daughter may not want the hutch or the dining room set, she might actually want a small, something small, like just a piece of jewelry or something smaller rather than these big furniture items that family members want to give. And so we sometimes recommend to our clients that they could just take a picture and journal about the item and then let it go. And even if it doesn't go to a family member, it still would be going to somebody who can either buy it from them or, you know, still use it. It just may not go to the specific person.
And Joe, when you can take something like that and get into a thrift store situation, say, does that at least make people feel better that, like, okay, maybe my son or daughter is going to use it, but it's going to find a new life somewhere?
Oh, absolutely. I think oftentimes the fact that they know it's not ending up in the landfill does set their mind at ease. As well, I mean, Marianne talked about journaling about a piece. Oftentimes when there is a significant piece, we'll have our clients do the very same thing, and we'll attach kind of an origin story with the item in the thrift store. So whoever's looking at it in the thrift store gets to be part of the journey of that item. So it really comes full circle, and it's a really nice process.
We're talking about downsizing when we move from one place to another, often something we do when we're older. Our guests have advice for the person moving and their close family members and friends who might be helping with the job. Marianne Garidi is with us from Moving Forward in Dane County. Joe Fishman from Empty the Nest in Minnesota. Joe, I know you try to minimize waste in the stuff that people get rid of, but that can be hard. I mean, I personally know I've ended up with stuff over my life that nobody else is going to want and nobody has a use for. How can we minimize waste in that situation?
Well, there is going to be, in almost every situation, an amount that is going into the landfill. But what we do is we take the things that are resellable that people want. And the good news is the demographics are the younger generations, the 18 to 30-year-olds, are very much into thrifting and buying things that have been used. So there is a huge demand for china, like Adam had mentioned, as well as furniture and other things. So we're seeing a real demand at the lower end like that, including books. What we'll do is we will get records to a secondhand record store. We'll get the books to a secondhand bookstore. We work with a number of local charities in Minneapolis, St. Paul here, Bridging, Salvation Army, to name just a couple, on the items that don't sell in the thrift store. So what we do is we try to take as many pieces as we can and get them into the hands of people who can use them before we would have to resort to tossing something or putting it in the landfill.
Marianne, I understand that part of the work you do is to help a person, say that senior, settle into their new home environment, whatever that might be. What can you do to make that feel as home-like as possible and maybe get a couple of ingredients from their previous space in there to make it feel more like home?
Sure. And actually, what we do lots of times is just try to recreate the space. And so before we start the downsizing process, we kind of like to go through and kind of identify the areas where the clients seem to spend the most time. So either a kitchen table or maybe a living room chair. And then they often have like areas like pictures hung a certain way. And so we kind of try to pick pictures of how they have their home set up. And then at the end of our move day. Actually, we try to have the apartment, the new space set up so they could live there comfortably at the end of their move day. So we don't leave people with boxes to unpack on their own. We typically unpack everything, hang the pictures, make the bed to make sure it looks like home at the end of that move day, because the transition has been, you know, probably long and exhausting.
And Marianne, I think we've all had the thought sometimes we've got an item like, oh, I don't need it right now, but I might need it someday. And you encounter this sometimes, I imagine, people saying, okay, I don't need that in my space, but I need someplace to store it just in case I need it. How do we work past that?
Sure. And we try to really talk to our clients through that process by saying, you know, if you're, sometimes we accumulate extra, you know, couple extra coffee pots or extra, maybe 10 extra winter coats. And we really try to just zone in on, okay, who can use those items today? And so instead of kind of storing things indefinitely in boxes and closets, we really try to discuss who can use these items today. And actually, it does help the downsizing process to know you're sharing things with people who could use them right at this moment.
Joe, when somebody's starting to go through things, and maybe Marianne could tackle this too, is there a place or a room that you suggest starting in to start winnowing through those possessions?
Marianne, I'll let you start with that one.
That's more your side of things? Okay, Marianne.
Yeah, no problem. So basically, we try to start in a room that's less emotional. And so usually we'll choose a spare bedroom or maybe an area in the basement that they don't go to very often. And we just kind of start the process there. And we feel like once you go through that area and you have a clear, empty space, it kind of motivates you then to go through the rest of the house. So we actually encourage people to start. People gravitate, you know, starting with the kitchen or some area that they're in all the time. And we really just say it's much easier if you start into an area where you're not so emotionally tied to all the items. And it's much easier to let things go if you haven't, you know, used them on a daily basis.
And Joe, you mentioned that sometimes at your shop, you end up with kind of the provenance story, the story of the person who had this item and how they used that. And we mentioned how that can make the person getting rid of the items feel better about it. Is that something that really affects the people who buy it? They appreciate having that story behind the thing that they're buying.
Absolutely. I think that most of the people who do that very much appreciate it. And to be able to have the provenance, you know, even if it's a handwritten story, you know, oftentimes people looking for vintage things, when they're a collector, they're looking for the provenance as far as bills of sale and things like that, but 95-99% of the people looking want that emotional provenance like we're talking about, and it does it does affect it.
We're talking about downsizing, getting rid of stuff to maybe move into a new smaller place, especially as we age. Our two experts stay with us, Marianne Garrity, president and owner of Moving Forward in Dane County, and Joe Fishman, owner of Empty the Nest in Minnesota. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been here, either moving yourself or working with maybe an older family member or friend who's going through this? What were some of the tough decisions you had to make, some of the obstacles you had to overcome along the way? Do you have some advice to share or maybe questions for our guests? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about downsizing to move into a smaller place. Maybe as we get older, kids move away, or we're seniors moving out of the home we've lived in for a while. Marianne Garrity is with us, president and owner of Moving Forward in Dane County, and Joe Fishman, owner of Empty the Nest in Minnesota. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been through this downsizing process, either for yourself or for a relative, a friend, family member? What kind of decisions did you have to make? What were some of the toughest decisions on getting rid of stuff, passing stuff on? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your own advice, your own questions. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Marianne, it makes me think maybe we should start early, not leave it for that, you know, couple weeks before we make that move. Has this experience changed your thought process on keeping and winnowing stuff?
Yeah, totally. Lots of times we'll do presentations to different groups around Madison here, and I always encourage people to downsize before you have to do it. So I would say 95% of the clients that call me, they're in rush mode. So something has happened, a fall or a death in the family, and then not only do they have to kind of start parting with their loved ones possessions and dealing with the move on their own in the case where a spouse has died, that just makes the whole transition much harder. So we always encourage people to start doing it while your spouse is living and he goes through his things, you go through your things, and you just have these discussions much earlier in life.
And Joe, when your company is doing a clean out now, at literally getting everything out of the space and then, as you say, donating it or reselling it or things like that, what does that sorting process looks like? It sounds like doing it for ourselves would be overwhelming. Doing it for somebody else would be just as overwhelming.
Well, actually, we find that it is easier for us than somebody doing it themselves because we don't have the emotional attachment. We've got a crew that will come in and, you know, somebody will take the kitchen, somebody will take the other rooms and start packing things up, putting them in boxes and moving them. And it's very much, I mean, it's, without the emotion there, it's literally a packing job and then a moving job. So we find in those instances, it goes much faster. Although there are instances where the owner sometimes is there, those jobs take a little bit longer because oftentimes we'll run across something that we're packing that they want to hold on to or whatever, and we'll have to work with them, like Marianne had said, that they do. You know, is this something you really need or is it something you need to let go?
And Joe, I read into this advice. I don't remember if it was something I read from one of you two or just randomly encountered the idea that, okay, maybe the person needs to look at that thing one more time, have that emotional connection, and then part with it intentionally. Like, do you have those moments where people just say, I need one more look and then I can move on from it?
Absolutely. It was about 8 months ago that brings to mind a clean out of an elderly woman in her 80s, a house that she had lived in for 40 to 50 years. We were going through the final clean out and she wanted to go from room to room as we were packing them up. And our clean out specialist, you know, was working with her, and it was very much that process. Mm-hmm. Hold on to it and then intentionally let it go.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kaylin is with us in Chisholm, Minnesota. Kaylin, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what'd you want to bring up, Kaylin?
Well, it's a personal question. I have traveled around the world, and I've saved or collected shot glasses, limoges, all that kind of stuff, and I know nobody wants them, but sadly, I don't either.
Yeah, okay, Kaylin.
Do with it, you know, and I don't want to throw it away. Every shot glass was $10 to $15. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Kaylin, thanks for the call. Joe, when you have something like that, a collector's items, not everybody's going to want them. Maybe the family members aren't going to want them. Is it possible to find homes for that kind of thing?
Well, the interesting thing is I'd say yes. The sad part for somebody who is a collector like Kaylin was is that you get 5 to 10 cents on the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes that's a hard pill to swallow for somebody who has collected over time, you know, these things, and there is that emotional attachment. But there's absolutely a home for things like that.
Thanks for that call. And Marianne, when you're working with that client, and a lot of us have collections of shot glasses or machine tools or whatever it might be, what kind of decisions do people make if they want to keep at least a taste of that collection with them?
Sure. And maybe like somebody might want to keep one, you know, one item from a collection that they've cherished for many years. And, you know, usually we just say it's good to remember that you enjoyed the collection, but then it's okay to let it go once you've kind of moved on. And even though it's not going to bring the financial value and you kind of know what you spent on the item, we try to take that away from the equation. Say, you know, just try to forget about it. Somebody else will enjoy it, but it's not going to be worth the financial money that you paid for it. So we have that discussion a lot, actually.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Verge in Door County. Verge, hello.
Hi. This is a great program. I've really enjoyed it. I'm an architect practicing up here, and I do a lot of work with people who are downsizing. And one of the things that I found to be extremely successful is if they can all manage to do this, if they can rent a place, a small place, for about 6 months, leave everything that they have in the home, and as I say, rent a smaller place for about 6 months, they begin to realize how they don't need much of the stuff that they have. And when they go back to their homes, then it's very, very easy to look at everything objectively rather than emotionally. It just gives that really helpful separation from the attachment to the things. And so if people are financially able to do that or logistically able to do that, I found that that's a very helpful transition route to go.
Interesting, Verge. Thanks for the call. Marion, I imagine, like, I could see, like, you know, replacing the rental space with a box in the basement for a while. And can I live without this for 6 months? And that sounds like an interesting experiment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's fascinating. We have this little trick that we do when people are deciding what clothes to get rid of in the closet. We have them actually flip the hangers the opposite way than you normally hold, you know, hang your clothes on. And then you could see how often you actually use the clothes that come down off of the hanger. So we have little tricks like that to kind of help people realize what they're actually using versus what just kind of sits in your closet.
And now, speaking of storage spaces, Joe, I know a lot of Americans use them for their extra stuff. Do you end up cleaning out often not just a home, but also that, you know, that rental storage?
Yes, we do. We do get calls oftentimes from people who, you know, they spend whatever it is per month on the rental store, on the rental storage, and they haven't been in it for years. And they keep getting the monthly bill, and they say, we just want to be done with it. Clean it out. I don't want to pay the bill anymore. And so we do that.
Let's take one more caller before we're out of time. Karen is with us in Lake Geneva. Karen, hello.
Hi. I was wondering, I'm 50 years old, and I've kind of become the repository of all of the family photos. And so while it's not absolutely necessary for me to downsize right now, at some point that's going to come, and there's bins and bins, and I just feel guilty throwing those old photos away.
Marianne, do you have thoughts on photo management? That's going to be important for a lot of people.
Yeah, photos are really tough, actually. And so basically, we encourage people to kind of look at the ones, and actually you have to just let some of them go. So you kind of start again with the easier ones, maybe things of like landscape pictures, things like that, then let those go. And then the ones that you really like, it's really helpful again to go either scan them in and keep them electronically, and then you could let the pictures go and just have a copy on your computer. Or the other thing, some people just make memory books of the key pictures. But then really, if the family members, you know, pass on them too, there comes a point that you just have to kind of let them go. And it's a tough one. But lots of times you just can't keep boxes and boxes of pictures from different trips. So that is a hard one. So we just, you know, encourage people to keep the most special and then let the others go.
Thank you so much for that call. And I want to thank both of you. Marianne, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Joe, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Marianne Garrity is the president and owner of Moving Forward, a company focused on helping seniors downsize. They're based in Dane County. Also with us, we heard Joe Fishman, owner of Empty the Nest. That's a Minnesota-based company that offers home cleanouts for people who are transitioning to new spaces for new stages in their lives. We've been talking about what happens when we downsize. It's a big chore, and there's a lot of emotion in it. You can still share your stories, by the way, and maybe your advice for other people in that situation if you've been through it. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, the author of a new book says farmland used to provide a good refuge for a lot of different kinds of wildlife, but that's changed for the worse over the years. Wisconsin has made efforts to boost broadband access to more parts of the state, but it's still lagging behind a lot of the country. We'll get the latest in the state and around the nation when it comes to bringing high-speed internet access to everyone. And we'll meet the creator of an app that aims to boost the visibility of Black-owned businesses in the Milwaukee area. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.